This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 141, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Preston Dennett about his book, Undersea UFO Base, an in-depth investigation of USOs in the Santa Catalina Channel. Preston began investigating UFOs in the paranormal in 1986. He is a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, and the author of 30 books and more than 100 articles on UFOs and the paranormal. Hi, Preston. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Always a pleasure and an honor. Thanks for having me on.
So we're going to talk about your book that's called Undersea UFO Base, an in-depth investigation of USOs in the Santa Catalina Channel. So USO stands for Unidentified Submersible Objects. When did you first start investigating these?
Really, right in the beginning. I mean, I came into this field as a skeptic in 1986. I found out my family, friends, and coworkers, some of them were having encounters. That's kind of what got me into this field. I joined MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, about a year later, became a field investigator, started investigating cases one after another. And very early on, I started getting USO cases, you know, objects coming in and out of the water. And by pure coincidence or synchronicity, it turns out the area where I was at, Southern California, there's a huge number of USO accounts right off the Southern California coast there. So I started getting cases right away.
When did people first start seeing them? Is this something that goes, you know, back before 1947 and Kenneth Arnold and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I found cases. I mean, there are USO cases going way far back, but off the California coast here, I found cases dating all the way back to about the 1920s, really. There's an author by the name of Wishar Survey, and he found many cases dating back to the 1920s and the 30s. This is back before UFOs were really a thing. They called them boats, which would fly out into the sky, sky boats. It's kind of how they looked at them. But I found other cases dating to about that time. Really, it ramped up in the modern age of UFOs in the late 1940s. But definitely some early cases. There was one really interesting early case in 1947, actually, when a Navy ship, the Maury, started tracking this object. And they became alerted to it because there was a number of ships. This is more towards the northern area of California. They started detecting, I guess, what you would, they called an undersea reef or an undersea mountain, but it kept moving around. It was causing all kinds of problems with navigation. So they called the Navy. This ship, the Maury, a Navy survey ship, came up and actually tracked this object down to Southern California. It went off the coast a few hundred miles. They got some real good depth sounding on it when suddenly it just disappeared. And following that, the reports came in pretty much every year.
If they call it an underwater mountain, it must have been pretty big.
Yeah, and this doesn't surprise me because while most reports of UFOs, USOs, a lot of objects that are 20 feet across, maybe 50, there are some involving much, much larger craft. There's one case that I researched in this area where the guy said it was as large as a stadium. It came out of the water, just pouring off waterfalls of seawater. We saw other smaller craft around it, who he estimated were about maybe 20 or 40 feet across. So this thing was many, many hundreds of feet big, huge. There are some big things down there.
Just how deep does the water get?
Surprisingly deep, actually. The continental shelf falls off pretty quickly into the Santa Catalina San Pedro Channel. It's got an average depth of about 2,000 to 3,000 feet. But there are places where it's almost a mile deep, 5,000 feet. So, you know, 2-3 kilometers. And there, you know, I talked to some people who are professional Navy folk. One guy's a submarine navigator. He's been up and down this area in submarines. He says there's all kinds of deep, deep canyons. It actually leads right up to the Monterey Trench in Northern California, which is extraordinarily deep. So yeah, and also an area where there's a lot of caves, both underwater and in the Santa Monica Mountain Range. So there's all kinds of caverns and caves and trenches that go quite deep and be a really good place for some of these USOs to hide and remain undetected.
And when you talk to people who are on submarines, did you ever get any reports of, what do they call them, like fast movers or something underwater?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got one really amazing case, which isn't in this particular area, but off the east coast of the United States. One of my favorite USO cases I've ever researched. I interviewed this gentleman by the name of Ray Sachs, who was an electrician's mate on the USS Clamagore. That's a Navy sub. And it wasn't known at the time, but this submarine was carrying nuclear-tipped torpedoes. And it was in 1971 that they were heading up the east coast of the U.S. at night, a few miles offshore, on the surface, going about 12 knots. The guy I interviewed was posted as a lookout, along with another petty officer. But the commander was there and the second in command when a USO came zipping in at about 100 knots. I mean, far faster than any submarine that we have, at least officially, can go. This thing came in from the stern and pulled up right alongside the submarine. Now, this would be considered a near miss if this was a normal vehicle, because as any person who does sea travel knows, you don't get within a quarter of a mile of another craft. That's far too dangerous. And this thing was right, I mean, just a few, maybe less than 100 yards, 50 yards, 50 meters off of the side of the Clamagore. And it paced this submarine for about 15 minutes. Did not appear on sonar. It made no noise. It appeared to be very shallow because they could see this brilliant, bright, circular white light hopped just a few feet down in the water, not deep at all. And one by one, the higher ranking officers came up on deck. They all wanted to get a look at it. And after about 15 minutes, it darted off at about 80 knots in another direction. And here is where it got really interesting for me, at least. The second in command turns to the commander and says, "Sir, how would you like me to record this in the ship's log?" And the commander said, this is according to the guy I interviewed, the commander said, "Officers who report this kind of incident do not move up in rank." So this incident was not officially recorded. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I had another submariner say, "Oh, yeah, we've had this exact same sort of thing happened. They're never recorded." We don't hear about the vast majority of incidents like this. I suspect it's far more common. And I honestly think that the reason for this particular encounter was because the Clamagore was carrying nuclear-tipped torpedoes. And if you look into this, UFOs, USOs are very, very concerned about our use of nuclear material in any capacity. Pretty much every nuclear power plant or waste dump or missile site has been visited at one time or another. So I think that's what was going on here. They were just checking it out. I don't know. It's pure speculation, but given that there's so many cases, I think that's what's going on here.
Yeah. And maybe also kind of saying, "Hey, we know what you're up to with those nuclear weapons."
Exactly. Yeah, they're not happy about it. And I don't blame them. I mean, I don't think any of us are happy about it.
So you have cases in the book that are also where craft are seen over the water or very near. So it's not just submerged objects that you have cases of.
This became a little bit problematic because, you know, what is a USO? A USO obviously is an object that's in the water. But if these objects are coming in and out of the water, it's clear a lot of the things people are seeing are probably, I mean, a UFO is a USO once it hits the water. So I included cases where objects were seen over the water, but I didn't call them UFOs. So I collected about 150 documented cases. It's far more than that now, but in the book. And about half of those were UFOs over the water, but people didn't see them necessarily coming out or going in. I suspect that they were coming from that direction because there are a lot of cases of these objects underwater. It's pretty rare to see, for someone to see it going in and out. Mostly it's coming out or going in, or floating on the surface for that matter. But yeah, a UFO becomes a USO the second it hits the water. And frankly, these, you know, they call them transmedium objects because they can travel in outer space. They can travel in our atmosphere. They can come into the water very fast without making so much as a splash in most cases. So they must have some sort of force field around them. But there are a few cases actually where they move through solid objects, trees, you know, the landscape, mountains and such. So these objects are really advanced and are doing things we simply cannot do.
Yeah, because I've heard that they can enter the water, and they, when they go underwater, they don't lose any speed. But any craft we had, as soon as it hits the water, you lose just about all speed.
Yeah, I've got a few cases, and you know, people often describe UFOs darting from one horizon to the other. And if you estimate that, that's, you know, it could be anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 miles per hour. And there's a few cases of this sort of thing happening underwater, which is mind-boggling when you think about it, because the water is not nearly as, you know, clear as the atmosphere. There's fish and there's mountains and there's all kinds of stuff going on under there. But they can move very, very quickly if they want. That's pretty rare, but I've got enough cases where you can definitely say it happens.
And so there's a case in the book that I think says 300 Boy Scouts saw a UFO. That's quite a mass sighting.
Yeah, quite unusual because, you know, there are cases where, you know, a few people might see UFOs, but to have a crowd of people like that is really, really unusual. I remember this case. This is at Camp Fox. This is on Catalina Island, and this occurred in 1952. And this, they saw this. This was at, during the day, at the morning, I believe. And this object was metallic, saucer-shaped. It had portholes, very low level, about 500 feet, 150 feet across. And it's very interesting because it was, when they first saw it, on its side, oriented sort of vertically. It did move to a horizontal position. It darted around. They also noticed another really interesting effect was that the atmosphere or the sky around this object was much darker than the normal sky. It looked dark blue or almost purple. So there was some weird optical effect, which I think points towards perhaps the very strong magnetic fields, maybe, or gravitational fields around this object, which was bending the light in some weird way. But it's a great case because these are Boy Scouts. The scout leaders were there. It was some 350 witnesses, actually. And I really like this case because the scout leaders had all the Boy Scouts sit down and write up a report. And they actually sent it to Colonel Charles Bicking at March Air Force Base, who did write back and, you know, thank them for the report. There apparently was no follow-up to it, but certainly a very well-documented case. And, you know, there's quite a few like it. Catalina Island, located about 26 miles in the channel here, right off Southern California. A huge number of reports come from that area. It's probably the best viewing point for the activity that's going on in this area.
Is this area still a UFO hotspot, or has it calmed down?
It's calmed down in the last year or two or three, even, but so has activity all around the world. But no, it's been active for a very long time, for most of history. In fact, I got a call from the Josh Gates Expedition X, I think it's called, to do a show. And they, you know, interviewed me via Zoom and asked me, you know, which area is the best to view activity from? We're going to go there and we're going to do some field work. And I told him probably, you know, the landward side of Catalina Island is the best place. This is where the most reports are. I charted them all on a map, put little dots for each case. And it's very, very thick in between Catalina Island and the mainland. So I told him that's where you should look. And what's really interesting, they interviewed me about, you know, my research in some of the cases, but they went out there and they actually caught it on film, this object coming up out of the water, zipping straight up real fast. There's nothing, we don't have flying submarines. This thing came out of the water, no doubt. They caught a few other things, that was the best. But I was really excited to see it, because often you see a lot of these reality shows and it's just talk and people walking around and speculating. But no, they actually caught a USO, a genuine USO on camera. And I keep saying this area, there's something about it. I'm not sure what it is, but it's very active.
And is that film, that video of that USO going to be on TV or YouTube or something?
It was on TV, Expedition X. They have a episode. I forget what the name of the episode is, but if you can look it up. It's online. And it was thrilling to see because I'm like, wow, this is what exactly people have been describing to me for so long. And they actually, yeah, got it caught on film. I talked to some contactees about it, had them look at it. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's genuine. Looks like a USO.
So wasn't there a case in the book where I think they said the object moved so fast out of the water that it sucked up a large column of water underneath it?
Yeah, there are a few cases of that. That's pretty rare. Yeah, Lake Casitas is right in. I mean, I think it's part of all of this. And I love this Lake Casitas case. This was in 1959. Lake Casitas is basically a reservoir, which was built in 1959. It's at the north end of the Santa Catalina Channel. But in 1964, there was an Air Force pilot, Frank Kinsey, who was visiting this lake with his brother-in-law. And he had a camera with him, by the way, and heard this water pouring down and turns and looks. And here's this object coming up out of the water, carrying up quite a bit of water with it. He said it was a round object with kind of a cone on top. It had a porthole. And he, looking through the porthole, he saw a face staring down at him. Now, he had binoculars with him. He picked him up and looked in. And, yep, it was a person, all right. He estimates this object was about 30 feet wide. It was quite loud. It was making a loud noise. It seemed to be rotating. There were several portholes. He said they were covered with what looked like real thick glass or perhaps plastic of some kind. And this object sort of changed color, turned bright orange-yellow. It was glowing. And he grabbed his camera and got a picture of it, which I put in the book. And you can see this object. It's not a great picture, but given that this guy is an Air Force pilot, this case was investigated by MUFON field investigators. He's a great witness. It was very well documented. It's the only case I know of where someone captured a photograph of an object coming up out of the water and claims to have seen a humanoid. It's too bad he didn't have that camera ready sooner. The photograph is a little blurry, but it's certainly interesting.
So when people report what they see, are they all kind of all different sorts of shapes and sizes, or do they all tend to be similar?
All different shapes. I mean, mostly it is your classic saucer, but there are spherical objects, cigar-shaped objects. Some of this might be a matter of perspective, but it's a surprising number of shapes. And there's also kind of weird blobs of light or strange cloud-like activity where objects are seen in going into clouds or coming out of clouds or abnormal clouds. I don't know how else to describe it because some of these clouds kind of light up and moving across the sky and they're not normal clouds. But yeah, pretty much the entire range, egg-shaped objects as well, V-shaped, quite a few different descriptions of shapes, which is normal. But yeah, this area is so active. There's something going on here and I can't quite figure it out. But definitely one of the most active areas on our planet in terms of USOs.
And you also talk about cases where there are maybe dozens of objects, even hundreds.
Yes. The first example of this occurred on June 14th, 1992. There was a wave of sightings going on in Topanga Canyon, which is right on the coast there. And several people saw one or two objects, or even 10 or 20. But I talked to one couple, a married couple who live very high in the mountain there, a couple of thousand feet up, and it overlooks the ocean. It overlooks the entire area, 360 degrees. So they had a great view. It was around 8 p.m., June 14th, 1992, that they were drawn outside by their dog barking and flashes of light. And they saw about 10 objects come up from below, from behind this ridge, which is very close to the ocean. And then it happened again about 10 minutes later, another 10 or maybe 20 objects. It happened a third time. They started counting these things because this went on for about 2 hours. And by the time it was done, they were so upset, they actually went back inside, closed the curtains, refused to go outside again. But they counted about 200 objects. And what's really interesting is it was some years later, I talked to another gentleman who had heard about my research, and he was actually on the other side of this mountain ridge, and he was viewing the same thing. He says these objects, a whole area would light up brilliant, bright, white light, so bright you couldn't look at it, and then all these objects would come out. But later, I interviewed yet another gentleman who was down at the beach. And this is what I mentioned earlier. He saw a very large stadium-sized object come up out of the water, dripping down huge amounts of seawater, and all these little objects, 20 or 30, I think he said, floating around it. So I don't know if these objects were coming up out of the water or from out of the land or something, but normally when someone sees a UFO, it's a little dot perhaps way high up there or coming from the horizon, and it moves overhead. These were coming from below. And there's another case very similar on Catalina Island. That was, I believe, in 1996. Or let me think for a second. No, that was 2013. I'm sorry. It was much more recent. Yeah, the witness was a gentleman I interviewed personally. He came over to my house. He was also part of a Boy Scout troop. And he and his friends and the whole troop was there. So, not one or two objects. It started out with three, but huge numbers of objects started to appear. All kinds of, it was very weird because there were some weird optical effects where the coastline, which is quite distant, appeared to be magnified to the point where they could actually see the cars traveling along the Pacific Coast Highway, which lines the mainland there. And that's, you know, over 20 miles away. You should not be able to see that. They could see a lighthouse in clear detail. They were later able to identify it. But there was a weird magnetic effect when exactly where all these objects were suddenly appearing. So I don't know exactly what's going on here, but it appears that these objects were perhaps coming out interdimensionally and causing a weird optical effect. But yeah, they had described well over 200 objects. All different kinds of shapes. Some were quite large. Most were very small, teardrop shaped. There were different colors, red, orange, blue, very fast. They would sometimes stop. They would sometimes turn at right angles. Occasionally they would go into the water or out of it. And this went on for quite some time. It's a really extensive case. I wasn't able to interview any other witnesses, unfortunately. They were very shy. And in effect, there was a cover-up because the scout leaders refused to talk about it. They tried to photograph it, but the cameras went down to zero power. This happens in a number of cases in this area and, frankly, all over the world. Try to photograph these things, and there's all kinds of difficulties that crop up. That case I love because it's so extensive.
Was there any response from the Air Force or any of the cases you have, do people see fighter jets going over a few minutes later or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that happened in a good 10%, maybe up as far as 20 of these cases, which is one of the reasons I doubt this is military, because these objects will appear and shortly later, they're chased by fighter jets off into the distance. And the fact that these go way, way back to the 1920s, and the way they display these absolutely incredible maneuverability, they're in large numbers. Sometimes they're following cars down the coast highway there, or hovering over people and putting on a display, which is not something that you would necessarily see from advanced military craft, which they try to keep secret. So there's a lot of reasons why this could not possibly be military. But I will say they do know about it. This has been verified by other researchers. And there is Port Hueneme Naval Base on the north end. There's Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station on the south end. San Clemente Island is Navy owned. This is just beyond Catalina. LAX is, of course, right along the coast there. There's no doubt authorities know about the activity here. There are enough cases to verify that for sure, yeah.
And have you any reports from military pilots?
Some. I did interview, well, guy, he wasn't a military pilot. He was a private pilot. And Toshi Inoue, he was flying over the coast there with a student and saw a very large cigar-shaped red glowing object. This is during the day. And he was about to report it, but he decided not to. He did ask the local airport there, is there any other air traffic in the area? And they said, no. Why? He's like, no reason. I'm trying to remember I don't know that I specifically talked to any Air Force pilots. I found some cases of this, certainly, but I didn't talk to them personally. But yeah, there's quite a few cases of people who are really good witnesses. One of my favorite cases was on January 15, 1956, when multiple residents of Redondo Beach saw this object kind of glide down out of the sky and float on the surface of the ocean just offshore, about 75 yards or meters. And it stayed there long enough that a bunch of people started gathering, including lifeguards and police officers from two counties. So there was a huge crowd of people watching as this object slowly sank down beneath the waves. Now, the police officers did call the Navy. They brought in divers to investigate. They rowed a boat out there. And as soon as they got out there, they could see it. It was much bigger than their boat. You know, this is 20, 30 feet across. It disappeared. They brought out a Geiger counter the next day to check for radiation. There was none. But it was shortly after this that the Coast Guard issued an explanation, which really angered local researchers at the time, like Isabel Epperson and Leonard Stringfield. They said it was a light buoy. Now, they even showed a picture of it. It's about the size of a foot or two across, like a large flashlight, which doesn't even come close to explaining what people saw, which was, 20 or 30 feet across. It was a debunking explanation. They will go to ridiculous lengths to explain this away and draw attention away from this subject in any way they can. But yeah, a lot of officials have reported this kind of activity.
And wasn't there one case where a jet nearly crashed into a UFO and even the passengers got injured?
That's right. Yeah. That's a very interesting case involving, I'm not sure I can remember the guy's name, but it'll come to me. He was piloting with a friend off of Catalina Island, and they saw what they thought was this unusual boat off of Catalina Island, but it didn't look like a boat because it was round. They decided to come around for a second look at it and got real close to it and could see figures on top of this boat. And this is when it struck them with a beam of light. And this is so strange because at this point, I think they had missing time because they said, described how time seemed to stop. And they felt all hypnotized and strange, and the plane crashed. One of the people actually in the plane did not survive the crash. The other guy did, but he was pretty badly injured, but he should not have survived because this plane did go underwater. He's not sure how he got out of it. It's a really interesting case. This was covered on the History Channel for when they called me to do a whole episode on the activity here. But yeah, that was a really interesting case. There are very few cases like that, but definitely does seem to be a USO that interfered with this guy's plane.
And there are other missing time incidents as well, isn't there? Was it called Contact at Palos Verdes? Am I saying that right?
Palos Verdes? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a case from Andruffel, I believe. And a really interesting case involving two witnesses, one who was actually a UFO researcher, I believe. This was in 1971, thereabouts. We don't know the people's name. They insisted upon anonymity. But they were driving along and came upon what appeared to be two extraterrestrial beings in front of their car. Looked quite unusual. They did have missing time. They ended up going under hypnosis and recalling that these figures were communicating with them, basically warning them about the fate of our planet. They did describe themselves being inside this craft. They saw tall beings with kind of grayish skin, a very thin mouths, flattish noses, six fingers on each hand. And so very much like your typical grays. They were physically examined, but yeah, they were warned. They were shown actually various atomic explosions and warned that these would take place unless humanity changed their pathway. This is a very common message. It was called the Dapple Gray Encounter because this occurred on Dapple Gray Lane in Palos Verdes. Palos Verdes is a peninsula that reaches out very much into this area. It's probably the second best location to view activity because it does rise up in a few thousand feet of elevation, giving you a great view of this area. It's one of several cases involving humanoids.
Didn't one of the guys say that he felt like the whole experience was like a display or something? And it might not be what it appears to be.
Yeah, there's, I think people often take on different interpretations of what's going on. Not everyone necessarily thinks it's extraterrestrial. I have to say I do. I think the ET explanation by far explains the totality of evidence. But I certainly can't fault people for, you know, interpreting the experience the way they want to, because it's their experience. And they certainly have the freedom to do that. But I have the advantage of having interviewed a lot of people and examined all these cases. And it's very hard to explain with any other explanation other than that these are physical craft, metallic, flying in and out of the water, very high speeds. I think they're extraterrestrial in origin. This is my personal opinion. But yeah, not everyone takes that interpretation.
Yeah, I think some people think they're crypto-terrestrials. Is that right? That they're native to this planet?
Yeah, which, I mean, it's an interesting idea, but I'm not sure how useful it is because we don't have any direct evidence pointing towards that. What we do know is that they have been around for millennia. I mean, since recorded history, really, because we've got evidence in terms of, you know, rock painting, you know, cave paintings or stone, pre-Columbian stone artifacts, or hieroglyphics in Egyptian culture. It goes way, way back. In ancient India, there's reports of vimanas. So it's clear that they've been around for a very, very long time. Probably, you know, since we started even recording history. So I'm not sure that they necessarily live here. I think if that were true, we would know it by now. But definitely they've come and go at will. It's apparently quite easy for them to travel the interstellar distances. And I've concentrated most of my research, honestly, on contactee cases, people who had direct contact. And this is what they have been told by the ETs, that yes, they can travel interstellar distances quite easily in a matter of minutes.
It's that, is it a quote? Arthur C. Clarke said, any technology sufficiently advanced will appear to be magic.
Yeah, and I think that's a great quote because we see that. And there are a number of researchers who try to wrap their heads around the fact that, you know, these objects are appearing to break the laws of physics or defy the laws of physics as we know them. I think the underlying word there is as we know them, because we don't have a full understanding of gravity. And it's clear that these objects are technological. They're metallic. There's case after case where they come down and burn the ground at several thousand degrees. You can tell this because the sand or the soil is glassified. So we know they're producing extremely large temperatures in a way that there's no natural phenomena that can do this. I mean, lightning can, but not in a perfect circle.
Yeah.
And we know that they can be quite heavy because they depress the soil several inches. And sometimes it's quite dense soil. This is something I like the landing trace cases because people say, oh, there's no hard evidence. I'm like, well, hold on a second. Look at the landing trace cases. And there's several thousand of these, many, many cases. And they represent really good evidence.
Yeah, this is what we see when we see scientists on TV, like I think Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he'll say, there's no evidence that ETs have ever visited this planet. And he's so sure about that, but he doesn't know at all of this, the depth and how complicated the UFO thing is. So it seems like him making that as an absolute statement is a bit too much.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's being disingenuous or just plain ignorant. A lot of skeptics, you know, I was a skeptic, so I kind of get it. But generally speaking, they refuse to even examine the evidence because they think they know. And that's not true science. And people say, well, you know, it's just anecdotal testimony. My response to that is observation is the foundation of the scientific method. Eyewitness testimony is considered evidence in a court of law. It's circumstantial, certainly. But when you have 10, 20, 30 people seeing something, you simply cannot ignore it and call yourself scientifically objective. And it's not just eyewitness testimony. The evidence for UFOs is mountainous. There's photographic evidence. There's radar returns, landing traces. But there's also implant removals. There's medical evidence of all kinds. Healings, some cases of injuries. There's animal reactions. There's electromagnetic effects. That alone is a whole area that you could write books and books upon. And that hasn't been done. This is still a new field of research that is just crying for more attention or more money or more scientific methods to be applied to it.
And you have in the book, there's cases confirmed on radar.
There are a few. It doesn't happen a lot. There was one on March 23rd, I think it was, 1957, where a bunch of witnesses saw objects over Long Beach. And the witnesses were actually Ventura County deputy sheriffs. And they called the Air Force, and sure enough, this was tracked on radar. Not only tracked on radar, but they made visual contact with it at Oxnard Air Force Base. They sent an F-86 in pursuit of these objects, which quickly moved upwards and away much faster than any craft that we have. They actually watched as it came to a complete stop, reversed course, darted around. They estimated that these objects were moving at about 3,600 miles per hour. Major Donald Kehoe, a hero in this field, tried to investigate this case, and he got some progress, but then immediately they put down a clampdown on the information on this. But yeah, there's many cases of these objects being detected on radar in this area. Another one in 1967 when Vandenberg Air Force Base, again, right along the coast here, detected numerous radar targets off the coast. And this was on five different radar sets. These objects were moving at about 80 knots, changing altitude. Again, they scrambled jet fighters, but weren't able to locate the objects in that case. But yeah, many, many cases of them appearing on radar. I mean, there was one guy I did interview personally who was on a Navy ship, Gary Wagner, Dr. Gary Wagner, actually. This was in February of 1983, and he was on the USS Long Beach. This is a nuclear-powered guided missile cruiser. And he was on the far side of Catalina, and these objects showed up. And at least 15 or 20 of his shipmates were with him watching this. This giant light shaped kind of like a half moon, he said, pulsating. And he tried to get in contact with the bridge, who said that this was not caught on radar. But they said, we're too busy. We can't talk now. And he wasn't able to get confirmation from them that this was on radar. But he was absolutely convinced this was unconventional, not anything that we have, certainly. But a really good witness, because, I mean, this is a Navy guy. And I talked to him personally. A lot of the witnesses have really good, you know, credentials. They would know if this is something unusual.
And is this area close to where the Tic Tac video was filmed?
To some extent. The Tic Tac video was a few hundred miles to the south. But as the UFO flies, I mean, that's basically seconds away. I mean, really, I did not know about the Tic Tac footage when I put this book together. It had not been publicized really to any extent. But I was really kind of vindicated when it came out, because I've been telling people for a very long time that this area has a lot of USO activity. So, yeah, this is very close to where all that happened.
So there's a case in the book about somebody that was, I think, a mathematician who was sleepwalking, and his daughter saw him walking.
Yeah, I do remember this. This was a really interesting case. Oh, gosh, I forget the actual date of this. His daughter had seen... Gosh, let me think for a second. I remember this case. Yeah, this was in Rolling Hills. This was sometime in the 1960s, I believe. And his daughter had seen all these objects, which would pulsate with beautiful lights, she said, moving on in all directions, very erratic, yet very, very graceful, she said. And quite a few of them. And this went on for some time. This is in the Rolling Hills area, right off the coast again. So this is overlooking the Santa Catalina Channel. And these are mostly distant sightings. But one time she was driving home and this object came right over her car. In fact, she could feel the magnetic fields from it. All her hair stood on end. Her car system, the electricity, you know, the radio, the horn, all the car lights went haywire, going on and off. She could hear this low whooshing sound. So this is definitely contact. It targeted her. So she told her parents. Her mom said, oh, yeah, you know, she had something happened. Her father was skeptical. But now this is where it got interesting to me, certainly. Her father is a theoretical physicist who was working on designing ultra-low frequency antennas for U.S. Navy submarines. And at the time of her close-up sighting, one evening, she woke up to see her father, apparently in a trance, sleepwalking, writing down these weird equations on his blackboard, high-order calculus. And the next morning, he wakes up, and he saw all of this written down. He thought someone else did it. He was very upset about it. Had no memory whatsoever of doing this, but his daughter saw him do it. So I wonder about this case, because there are a number of cases where contactees have developed a sudden interest in mathematics or quantum physics or became inventors or trying to design magnetic free engines. I suspect that there's something along those lines going on here, given that his daughter had just had this very close encounter.
You write in the book a whole load of stuff about a possible base that was just off the coast and that Jimmy Church was involved with it, but it turned out to be not a base at all and just natural.
Well, I'm a bit on the fence about it, to be honest. There's this, and I had charted all of these things, all these sightings on a map. And they were really clustered in one area, which is right off the coast of Malibu. And I'm like, gosh, there might be something going on here. I had a few contactees tell me that they thought there might be a base in this area. And it certainly would explain the high levels of activity, but I didn't have any really good evidence to support it other than, you know, some eyewitness testimony and some speculation. But then I was contacted by a researcher who said he'd found this anomaly off the coast of Malibu. And it showed this very sort of smooth surfaced area. And I thought, well, that certainly does look unusual. Robert Stanley, he's another researcher who had also identified this quite some time earlier. But later, Jimmy Church was contacted apparently by this same guy, and he was able to use Google applications to sort of get a side view of it. And with this, you can get a much better look at this so-called Malibu anomaly. And if you look at these Google images, and there's quite a few of them, it's now been scrubbed out on Google Earth, by the way. You cannot look at it. Just recently, this has all been, I mean, within the past year, erased. But this was in 2014, and Jimmy Church contacted me because he knew about my research, and you can see photographs of this. It's got a very flat surface. It's got what looks like columns. Looks like a deep tunnel going in there. It looks artificial. It's quite striking. Now, there are skeptics. There's, you know, archaeologists and geologists who have looked into this, professional scientists. This is an earthquake fault called Sycamore Knoll. And there are some who say, well, no, I don't think there's anything unusual to this, because some of the Google images are quite different and don't show a tunnel. And the columns or pillars are somewhat uneven. But there are other images which clearly do show a tunnel. And if you look at it, yeah, it looks very much like Roman architecture, perhaps. So I'm a bit on the fence about it. But I have to tell you, after I put this book out, I was contacted by one of the people I had interviewed, who actually turns out he's mega famous, Merrill Fankhauser. He's very famous for the song Wipeout. And I interviewed him because he was part of this whole story. His friends had gone down to the coast and would watch these objects coming in and out of the water. He didn't go that night, so he didn't see it firsthand, but he had, you know, some firsthand testimonies that certainly contribute to the validity of all this going on here. And he called me back later. He says, I've got some interesting information for you about this so-called Malibu anomaly. Like, really? It's like, yes, I was in Las Vegas, and he was approached by a Native American elder of the Chumash tribe, the Gabrielano Indians. And they lived in this exact area, stretching back a few thousand years. They've got an oral tradition, an oral history that goes way back. And they know about this anomaly, they told him. They said, oh yeah, we know about it. We have stories going back saying that I think it's a few thousand years ago, the ocean levels were quite a bit lower, and this object was actually visible, and they could fish off the end of it. But what's interesting is they said, we know about this structure, and we didn't build it, but they absolutely felt like this was an artificial structure. And I think it probably was. I'm not prepared to say that this is a base or anything, but there's a lot of structures on our planet that are megalithic, you know, built many, many years ago. That, and so this might be one of them. I don't know. I was contacted by some Navy folks who said that there are tunnels in this area leading from Edwards Air Force Base, which is quite some distance away in the high desert, all the way out to the Santa Catalina Channel that submarines can go in and out from. So I don't know if that's true. I did get that testimony from two or three sources. I obviously can't verify it. But yeah, there's, it's just another sort of piece of the puzzle to what's going on here.
And this anomaly, just how big is it?
Oh, it's quite large. It's miles across. It's about 2,000 feet deep, I believe it is. And it's massive. I don't know that it's been, let me see. I think it's about 2,700 feet wide. They're estimating about 630 feet tall. But the actual plateau on top is over a mile wide. It's like 1.3 miles by 2.4 miles, 6 miles out to sea. This slab on top is at least 500 feet thick. This is a massive structure of some kind. So certainly it could not have been built while the water is there. This must have been built when the sea level was much lower, assuming it was an artificial structure. But also, you know, what's interesting to me is why would authorities erase this from Google Earth if there's nothing to it? Why would they not want people to see it? When Jimmy Church went out with this, it totally went viral. I put an article out for Fate magazine, and that also went viral. I mean, it was published all over the web, translated into different languages. There's an enormous amount of interest in the activity going on here. And I think there's still a lot of research that needs to be done. I will say that there was a TV reality show, Location, hosted by Rob Lowe and his two sons. They took a submersible out there, an unmanned submersible, to try and investigate this Malibu anomaly. Unfortunately, this was a shoestring budget. They were only down there for, you know, less than a day. Very, very dark down there. They didn't find any evidence that this was an artificial construction. But I suspect if you threw some money at this, some time and money in scientific research, you might find some very unusual things.
And somebody picked up some weird radio signals, didn't they?
That's right. This is researched by Robert Stanley. He contacted this guy who started picking up these weird signals, tones, kind of, and he's tried to pinpoint them. And finally, he was able to pinpoint them. These were around 54 kilocycles on a 12-meter radio band, but it was very steady and very strong. And it was coming from the Malibu area. Robert Stanley interviewed the guy, got the recordings of this, and found out that they were able to use a rangefinder and kind of zero in on it to a certain extent. And this was coming from this same area of this anomaly. So I don't know, it's kind of ambiguous here. It's hard to say where exactly these are coming from. They can't prove it, but it certainly is interesting. And again, another piece of the puzzle to something going on that's really strange in this area.
Well, it's been great talking to you again. The book is called Undersea UFO Base, an in-depth investigation of USOs in the Santa Catalina Channel. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
They can, yeah. Amazon, it should be at other online retailers. You can go to my website, too, if you want to read excerpts of it or my other books. I think it's important that people know that USOs do exist. It's not just in the sky. They're coming down into our oceans. Not only our oceans, lakes and rivers. I've got a number of cases of that, reservoirs. So I appreciate you having me on the show.
You got another book coming out soon? You seem to have one every few months.
I'm keeping busy. Yeah, my latest was Not From Here, Volume 5. That was out about a few months ago. I'm working now on Symmetry, the sequel. Symmetry is probably one of my most successful books and certainly one of my favorites, involving the contacts of Dolly Safran. And just touched the surface with her experiences, so that's going to be the next one. But I'm busy. I've always got a couple of irons in the fire. Like I said, this is an important subject. People deserve to know the truth.
And do you have a YouTube channel?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Yeah, I'm putting out pretty much all my research on my YouTube channel. Every Friday evening, USA time, I release a new episode covering humanoids and all different aspects, including a lot of my USO research. And I also have my own podcast, which I co-host with Dolly Safran, that airs live each Monday evening at 5 p.m. USA Pacific time to 8 p.m. Eastern time, where we interview all kinds of experiencers and researchers and people who have, you know, found out some interesting things about this subject.
Well, it's been great having you back on, and you'll have to come back again when the new Symmetry book's out.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah.
And that was an interview with Preston Dennett about his book, Undersea UFO Base, an in-depth investigation of USOs in the Santa Catalina Channel. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month, and in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression, and I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And didn't Kim Carlsberg say that the room she was in was so big, there were so many kind of operating tables with people on them that just stretched off into the distance?
Exactly, yeah. She says it was quite large. She said it was like an auditorium, is how she put it. And she felt that she and the other people there were being prepared for future events.